This is the Gold Newsletter Podcast, your home for investment, economics, and geopolitics. For our publications and archives, go to goldnewsletter.com. Welcome to another episode of the Gold Newsletter Podcast. This is your host, Fergus Hodgson, and I am excited to have a guest whom I've been following for a while, at least through his campaign and more broadly his political party. We're all following, or many people are following, this campaign race for the presidency in the United States, and it is one of the most bizarre we've seen in a long time, for better and for worse. And my own backstory is that I came to the United States first in 2002 and then began studies in Boston in 2003. And I learned a lot about the U.S. political system, its history through third-party or minor-party candidates. And that was basically because they would say what they thought or what they really believed. They would shoot from the hip rather than having some prepackaged or some pampered version of history or version of what needs to be said. And in particular, both the Libertarian and Constitution parties came to my attention. And this cycle, the Constitution Party has nominated Darrell Castle and Scott Bradley as his vice presidential nominee. So I have the privilege to have Darrell Castle on today. So thanks so much for giving us your time, Darrell.
Thank you, Fergus. I'm glad to be with you.
Right. And just a little bit of his bio. He is from Tennessee. He studied political science and history before serving in Vietnam. And then he completed his law degree before opening up his own law firm. And he's been there for as long as I've been alive. So he's been working since the early 80s. And he's been with the Constitution Party right since its founding, which was in the early 1990s. What was the basis for the Constitution Party, which originally was called the U.S. Taxpayers Party? Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, Fergus. We started the party. It was really the idea of one man. That was Howard Phillips, who served in the Nixon administration. And Howard came to the conclusion that the Republican parties and the Democrat parties were never going to take the country where he felt like it needed to go. And so a bunch of us came together under his leadership, about five people, and we decided to form a new party, a third party, that was dedicated to the original intent of the U.S. Constitution. And that's how I became involved. I was one of those people. I think the other four are all dead now. So,
oh wow,
I'm kind of the last man standing. So, but nevertheless, I've been in the Constitution Party since then. So 24 years now, it has existed. This is the seventh presidential election that we've been involved in.
Many people perhaps don't understand the need. I mean, I do, because I see what you're talking about. That as many people say, we don't have a two-party system, we have a one-party system, and it's hard to tell which party is which often, and often they switch places, and then they'll accuse each other of being evil when that party held a similar position. For example, the Obamacare scenario with the mandate. I mean, many of us know that that was a Republican idea back in the 1990s, and then Mitt Romney introduced this in Massachusetts himself before campaigning against it on the federal level. So there is this challenge. And one concern to me is you actually have your own podcast. People should check out I think it's the Castle Report.
Yes.
I've been listening to that podcast. I mean, in addition to producing this one, I'm a podcast addict, and I'll say that you've not been producing it for the last month or so. Is that going to come back on the air sometime soon?
Well, I stopped doing it during the campaign because, number one, I was on the road a lot.
Right.
But number two, to be perfectly honest about it, my enemy use it as a method to attack me. So,
oh, right.
I've kind of, I probably will start it back when I'm able to do that, but we will see.
Yeah, that's so ironic. No good deed goes unpunished, because you challenge the status quo in that podcast, and many people want to put names on that or attack it. As in the think tank world, we say it's the Overton window. What is the acceptable range of discourse? And of course, you go outside that, which is necessary. But one of my concerns is that I've seen these third parties. I've seen Ralph Nader come and go. And then, of course, there was Perot back in the 1990s, although that was before I was in the United States. And they just haven't seemed to have gained the traction. And in some ways, the Constitution Party maybe even is weakening over time. I'm not sure whether that's your perspective, but do you want to comment on people why there has not been the rise of the alternative parties, why we seem to be stuck in this duopoly?
Well, I would address it like this, Fergus. If you look over the 6,000 years that man has recorded his history on the earth, you read continually, as far back in history as you want to go, that power corrupts. Power corrupts the mind and the morals. And you can trace civilizations across time. The Roman civilization is the most obvious.
Sure.
The bigger it gets, the more corrupt it becomes. The more corrupt it becomes, the less liberty we have. So when I talk about limited government, sometimes people are frightened by that because they think it means that their favorite program might cease to exist. But what I really mean by limited government is, I mean, what do you want? Unlimited government? Power has to be limited. The founders of this country understood that. They didn't even trust themselves. So they set up a government that was limited and controlled by the states and the people, and that each individual section of this government, the judiciary, the legislative branch, and the presidential branch, all had limits on their power. And those limits are set out explicitly in the Constitution. In Article 1, Section 8, the 17 powers that the federal government actually has were enumerated. So that is an idea that this party has. It's based on the same principles as the founders. It's based on their original intent. And it's an idea that its time is coming because as the situation gets worse and worse, at least it's my hope that people will return to the idea that power has to be controlled and it has to be limited, or it's always going to be corrupt and liberty is going to cease to exist.
That's just a very touching or sad point you make about how it does corrupt and how people get a piece of the pie or the piece of the patronage, a piece of the crony money, and it really disrupts their intellectual independence. I think of one example. I've spent a lot of time in Florida and dealing with the Cuban exiles. And I'm not sure whether you know, but the federal government has a program of government media or propaganda, if you want to call it, called the Board of Broadcasting Agency. I'm not sure what it's called, but the total agency costs about almost $1 billion. And the unfortunately, all these Cuban exiles who just fled government propaganda and the lies of the Cuban regime are now working in a government agency for the United States, many of them. And it just is, it's tragic for me to see them basically just switching from different sides and their anti-government propaganda position being corrupted by the United States. Yeah, it's just perplexing to me that so few people see this. Maybe it's because large media outlets have been reluctant to give attention to the minor candidates, even though, in my view, they give a much more interesting perspective. Why do you think it's so tough for the minor parties to get a breakthrough?
Well, Fergus, I'm a historian by nature.
Yes.
I would take you back to Vietnam days. You're too young to remember this, but that war was fought for the first time in history on our televisions. Mothers and fathers in America could see their sons suffering in the jungles. And it was very explicit what was happening. And the media, it eventually forced an end to the war. And the media looked at it and they said, this is never going to happen to us again. We have to do something about this. So what then media was controlled by something like 50 different countries, companies
right.
in America. Now it's all boiled down to only four. So four corporations control virtually everything you see, read, hear, and so forth. And when you really boil it down even further, those four companies, their boards of directors are all controlled by the same types of people. And they don't want their message to get out, just like, you know, the controversy about Mrs. Clinton's health and so forth. Rather than taking an objective look at it and saying, look, we need to know if this woman is really too sick to hold this office or not, they just say, oh, it's all just a conspiracy theory, you know. And all people are asking for is an actual real disclosure. So they're complicit.
Yeah, that
in the crimes of the government.
Yeah, that is a good example, because I am just in almost shock or disbelief that this woman, who is visibly in terrible physical condition, is still the supposed front runner, and the capacity for prominent media outlets to somehow dismiss this just defies imagination. I don't understand how people can take it seriously. And one of the challenges, I guess, is that you and I suspect, we live in alternative media, right? In the podcasts or the online news websites. And so I forget that most people are plugged into these satellite or subscription television cable channels, which give very limited coverage. Now, one of the challenges that maybe philosophically or theoretically to the Constitution Party is that many would say, well, if the Constitution is so great, why have we strayed so far? Why has it failed to keep a limited government?
Well, the answer to that is, as that I gave you earlier, power corrupts the mind and the morals. Power will not be contained. It wants more and more. And unfortunately, the founders, when they wrote this document, they did limit power, but they did not make it self-enforcing. They gave no method for making sure that vice does not supplant virtue in the public square. They talked a lot about virtue and the necessity for virtue in public office, but they gave no method of ensuring that virtue would continue over time. So vice has supplanted virtue, because power is innately evil and it's innately corrupt. And unless the people, through their representatives, insist that it be limited, it will always burst its chains.
Right. And, well, there are some systematic, I think, changes or pieces of history which we could explore that I think have really tipped the scales in favor of the federal government against federalism or against delegation to the states. And, of course, there was the war between the states, which was a very unfortunate episode in U.S. history. And then came the Federal Reserve System, which is one thing I wanted to touch on. I've got your press kit here, and it lists your campaign issues. First, adherence to the Constitution. Second, withdrawal from the United Nations. Amen to that. And the Federal Reserve System is the third one on the list. And one of the challenges, I worked as a reporter in Louisiana a few years ago, and we would see how even if the state legislators wanted to do something, they would be either too afraid or their hands would be tied, and that the federal government would both be funding their operations and would threaten to withhold funding if they resisted anything. And second, there would just be federal mandates that were almost impossible to get out of. So they'd either have to, if they wanted to be independent, they would have to forego funding, and two, basically engage in a Tenth Amendment style nullification activity, which few of them had the courage to do. And this concerns me, because the Federal Reserve System gives enormous leverage or power to the federal government to borrow to some degree without limit, and then buy off the states. Now, I mean, that's just one problem, but it seems to me that is an underlying or systemic problem. I mean, what are your reasons for saying we should end the Federal Reserve?
Well, you are certainly correct in your assessment. I would point out further that in the original document, the original Constitution, before it was amended to allow the federal government to tax our income, originally the Constitution said that there would be no direct tax by the federal government on the American people. So what I propose is to return to what I like to call a constitutional tax, and that is a tax that is not on income, but is apportioned to the states as per the census. In other words, if the state of Tennessee, my state, had 1% of the nation's population, then the state of Tennessee would be responsible for collecting taxes appropriate to 1% of the budget. So it would do several things. Number one, it would encourage the representatives that represent the people from the state of Tennessee to try to hold down the federal budget rather than making it bigger. Their incentive would be to reduce the taxes on their own people. Number two, it would empower the states and disempower Washington. The states would no longer, as you pointed out, have to go to the federal government on their knees for money. The other way around, it would be the other way around. Washington would be its power would be reduced. The power of the states would be increased, and people could keep all of their money. Now, the way this money could be raised is the states could raise it however they see fit. In other words, in Alaska, for example, they would probably tax their natural resources, their petroleum industry, things like that. And in Hawaii and Florida, it would probably be tourism. In Nevada, obviously, it would be gambling. And people would be free. Imagine what it would do to the growth of this economy if we no longer had our incomes taken from us. So it's another way of reining in the corruption of power and of limiting power that people could have if they really wanted it.
When I lived in North Carolina, I was a fiscal policy analyst. And one of the challenges with these direct taxes, and people don't seem to realize this, is it's not just the robbing of the fruits of your labor or taking of your income. It is a tool of tyranny. It's a tool of manipulation. I wrote an article about how people will either get married or get divorced because it'll change their tax burdens. They will do all sorts of things to improve their tax position. And the irony of this manipulation is that many people do it with glee. They happily jump through these hoops and abide to get some sort of tax advantage. And I just think, I agree that if you could put this back in the state's hands, that would be an enormous, vastly superior position. One of the challenges, though, and this is where one of the candidates for the Constitution Party, the first one I was familiar with, this is back in, I think, 2004, was Michael Perutka. And he said that something like 90% of the activity of the federal government was not justified by the explicit powers of the Constitution. And often I wonder, how do you get from A to B? It's just the U.S. federal government is just so distant from anything. I mean, I don't know if anyone even believes that they abide by the Constitution at this point. How do you actually undo this mess?
Well, it is a very difficult problem, obviously. And we have a situation now, as you pointed out in your introduction to the show, that this election cycle that we're going on right now is so bizarre because Mrs. Clinton, she understands what the Constitution is. She knows that she has to occasionally mention it. Mr. Trump, I don't think even understands what it is. He really doesn't feel any need whatsoever to be bound by anything. So both of these people feel like there are no restraints on their own power. And the Constitution really is what it says it is, the supreme law of the land. And what's happening, what I'm afraid is going to happen, and what I think will have disastrous implications for the country and really for the whole world, is when society in general starts to understand that there are people who run this country, and with it, one could argue, the entire world. These people feel bound by nothing. They feel totally apart from us. But the law doesn't apply to them. There are two sets of laws, one for little people like us and one for those people. Now, that the evidence of that, I would point to the fact that, the diabolical criminality of Hillary Clinton is so obvious that a blind person could see it in 30 seconds. And yet she has a very good chance to become president of the United States. That is two sets of laws. So the rule of law is out the window. the Constitution is the rule of law. That is why we insist so much that it be followed. It's not because we think those words written on a piece of parchment 240 years ago are sacred. We think they represent the rule of law and the ability of people to govern themselves. That is in great, great danger now. If people would just stop and listen, they would be able to understand, I think, what's at stake here.
Right. And I just want to clarify, I forgot for a second that it is Article 1, Section 8, which lays out the 17 powers of the federal government. And as you can see, I mean, it's very limited. Yes, it includes the post office, which is one thing which the federal government does not need to do. But the post office actually is a federal power that is in the Constitution. And I encourage anyone who is not yet to look at Article 1, Section 8 and just see what are these powers, such as maintaining a navy. And in terms of money, it says coin money and regulate the value thereof. So when they said coin money, they meant literal hard money. They meant coin in terms of gold and silver and not this funny money we have in this era. And let me see what else you have here. Withdraw from the United Nations, yes, adherence to the Constitution, Agenda 21, and pro-life. And okay, I'm not sure which of these we want to get into the most, but one thing that you mentioned on another show you did was the way that the federal government now is the majority owner of land in many states. And your vice presidential candidate is an expert on this. How did it come to be that the states that created the federal government or agreed to it and then other ones joined later on, how did they just give away the majority of the land to the federal government? It makes no sense to me.
Well, again, I sound like a parrot, but power corrupts. And over time, it has been gradual, you know, like the old saying in my profession, how did you go bankrupt? Slowly at first, then all at once. In Nevada, the federal government owns about 90% of the state of Nevada. So if Nevada were applying for statehood now, it would not have enough sovereign territory to qualify. I think Wyoming is about 70%. The federal government owns a lot of states, even in the East. It's just more egregious in the West, and they don't ask anybody's permission. They just take it. Like when Bill Clinton was president, he took I think it was 2 million acres in the state of Utah. That was one of their state's big coal producing areas, and he set it aside as some type of national monument or something. And there were all kinds of rumors about why he did that, but the strongest one is because he was trying to help the Chinese coal industry. But nevertheless, he just did it. And President Obama is doing the same thing. He's trying to take a lot of land in the state of Maine away from its rightful owners and just set it aside. It's just arbitrary power that the people simply should not permit, but they do. They just go on about their daily lives. It doesn't affect people in New York when someone takes, a better word would be steals, 2 million acres of land from the people of Utah. You know, if he took Manhattan and said, I'm going to set this aside as a national park, so you know, Wall Street, you can't do business here anymore, then they would understand and their ox would be gored. And they would get on their horses and ride, but that's the way it is, unfortunately.
Yeah, let me take you back maybe to the strategy of the Constitution Party, because I'm a little bit frustrated that you have not received more coverage. And I've been familiar with the party for more than a decade and seen it standing, as you can tell, on just strong principle. We believe in the American idea, the Constitution, adherence to it. And that is very limited government, individualism, individual rights. And that, for whatever reason, that just hasn't been so popular, except now this is where there's maybe a spark of hope or opportunity. With the rise of more constitutionally minded Republicans, particularly Ron Paul, I'm sure you're very familiar with him, and then his son to some degree, and I hear that you were actually a supporter of Ted Cruz. Will there come a day when the Constitution Party can find a candidate within the Republican Party they will actually be willing to support and embrace?
Well, we had a Republican congressman in 2012. Virgil Goode was our candidate.
Right.
He was a Republican in U.S. Congress for 12 years. But let me talk about what you just said for a second. In 2008, when I was vice presidential candidate,
yes,
Ron Paul did endorse Chuck and me. And yes, I was a supporter of Ted Cruz. And in my opinion, Senator Cruz would be better off in my party than he would in the Republican Party because of the people who control the Republican Party, a tiny handful of people. They are never going to let him get the nomination. Hopefully that's obvious to him now. I wish him all the best. I hope I'm wrong. But he could come into my party and he could build something and make this party a national force by himself. And we could achieve something. But nevertheless, people want to be where the power is.
Right.
They don't want to be on the outside looking in like I am. You know, I have a message. I have a message that says I want to limit government. Everybody else has a message that says I want to expand government and make it more powerful so it can do what I want it to do. And I say I want to limit it so that the people's freedom will be protected. And that's a message that apparently not everyone wants to hear.
Right. It is unfortunately a winner-takes-all system, at least in the at the presidential level. And that means that if you have, let's say, five different parties similar to the Constitution Party, even if you have 70% of the support, you'll be dividing your support between each other, if you follow what I mean. So, I mean, in this case, it seems clear that you are so distinct from both Republican and Democratic candidate that who knows whether you're taking votes from which person, or it's hard to see. But if you were to have two parties of a similar nature battling it out, that would be, it seems like, a suicidal approach. At some point, I'm not sure what the long term goal is of the Constitution Party. Are you trying to get more people elected at the local level? Or are you just trying to educate people? Because I will say that to me, the greatest value of both the Libertarian Party and the Constitution Party is the education. Because this time I'm not such a fan of Gary Johnson, of the Libertarian candidate, because I'm concerned that he's not a constitutionalist. But there is, I learned about U.S. politics through the Constitution Party to a large degree. And is that one of the main goals?
Well, it's one of the main goals, yes. When I accepted the party's nomination, I was interviewed a couple of minutes later by Al Jazeera, and I told that reporter that she asked me the question, since it's impossible for you to win, why are you doing this? And I said, well, my first goal is to be president, and my second goal is to have an opportunity to spread the principles that I believe in around the country, which you could refer to as education. And the third goal is to build state parties and help Constitution Party candidates win elections on the local level. Well, she totally misquoted me, but nevertheless, those are the things that I want to do. I think that it is vitally important that we elect people on the state and local level, of course, but I am afraid that while we sat here for 20 years trying to build at the grassroots level, the powers in Washington are destroying our country, and we might not have that much time left. So as my old mentor, Howard Phillips, believed, and I still believe today, a Constitution Party president could change this country in only 4 years. In the direction that it should go, not the fundamental change that Barack Hussein Obama promised, which is one of the few things he's actually been truthful about, that he would fundamentally change America. You know, I seek to change it to free the people and to constrain government.
Right. I want to say, people, if you want to check out Daryl Castle's website, it's just Castle2016 or Castle2016.com. And he's got lots of information there. And then, as I said, his own podcast is the Castle Report, which is available on iTunes and anywhere else you want to download. And you can get his archives. So he hasn't released new shows, but he does have archives. Is there any other place you want to direct people to?
Those are the two places, Fergus. I would tell people that they can go on Castle 2016 and donate money to us, which is something that we desperately need right now.
Sure.
The other thing is, if anyone wants to actually reach my campaign and communicate with me personally to ask a question or to for some other reason, they can email my campaign manager, and that would be Joan, J-O-A-N, at castle2016.com.
Right on, Daryl. I wish you the best of luck with your campaign, and I wholeheartedly support what you're trying to do, okay?
I appreciate it, Fergus. I didn't even know you were out there, but I am glad that you are. I enjoyed talking to you a great deal. Thank you.